major theme in Parshas Vayeshev is Lashon Hara, evil speech, slander, defamation. The Parsha begins with Yosef saying, it says, Vayaveh Yosef es dibas samra el avihem. Yosef slanders, brings tales about his brothers to his father, Yaakov. There are different accounts in the Midrashim, what exactly the slander was. Certain averos, Avraham and Achai, what he thought were certain averos, but whatever it is, the Torah calls it slander, dibas samra el avihem. Because of that, that triggers the whole cycle of the Mechiras Yosef, the sale of Yosef, with the eventual descent to Mitzrayim and the stay there for several centuries. Pretty significant consequences. Later in the parsha, we have the interaction between Ashes Potiphar and Yosef. She makes advances toward him. He resists her advances. She's outraged or in self-defense. She actually slanders him to Potiphar. She claims that he made improper advances to her, wanted to rape her, and she ran away, turned the chutzpah to turn the story entirely on its head. And he winds up going to jail again because of this. Torah doesn't use the word diba, but essentially that's what it was again. It was a calumniation of Yosef to his master, her husband, to Potiphar. Yosef spends time in jail. And there's a kind of meta issue which is discussed by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky in the beginning here. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says he was once asked by a student of his, how do we understand the Torah itself? The Torah seems to be committing Lashon Hara by telling you the tale, the horrific tale of the sale of Yosef by his brothers. That seems to be Lashon Hara itself. How can the Torah do that? And the truth is, I'm not sure why the question is here. The Tanakh is full of cases of the recounting of sins of major biblical figures. In this parsha itself, we have Yehuda's sin later with, Chazal call that a sin with turned out to be Tamar, he thought she was a Zona. We have Reuven, last week's parsha, Moshe Rabbeinu is criticized a number of times in the Torah, David HaMelech, throughout the Torah, throughout in Chazal, and Talmudic literature, we've discussed some examples earlier, with even Avram, there's some of the Rishonim criticized. There are no lack of cases where Chazal, or the Torah Shebichtav, or the rabbinic tradition criticizes people in the Torah and tells us that they did things that were wrong. So why exactly the Rabbi Yaakov is concerned all of a sudden here about the sale of Yosef is not entirely clear, but he records that was a question that was posed to him by a student. He gives two answers. He says his second answer, turn to a second answer first. His second answer is that the brothers didn't do anything wrong, or they didn't think they were doing anything wrong. They acted in good faith. They made what they felt was an objective decision, that he was a danger to their entire family, that he was endangering them, and that he was deserving of death. Now, it's actually quite interesting. When my impression always was that they were actually wrong, whether they meant well or not, my impression is they actually committed a sin. When I was looking around, it's surprisingly difficult to find a clear and unambiguous authoritative statement in Chazal that they actually committed a great and heinous sin. The closest I was able to find is the Medrash of the Asara Harugei Malchus. We read on Yom Kippur, on Tisha B'Av, we read that there is the sad story of the Asara Harugei Malchus who were killed, the charge against them by the Roman official who killed them was that he says, read me the Torah, and the Torah it says that kidnapping is a capital offense. So he asked them, and what happened when your ancestors kidnapped Yosef and sold him to slavery? Isn't that a capital offense? And they didn't have apparently a good enough answer. So he said, okay, I'm going to kill all of you because of that sin. You're such great men. You're worthy of standing in their stead and suffering their punishment. Now that the standard text we read on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av doesn't actually make it that clear that there was any justice in that official's claim. He made some kind of, history has no shortage of cases where hostile governments trumped up charges against Jews. But there are midrashim that do indicate that even on a heavenly level, that was the reason for their death. It was to expiate the sin of the sale of Yosef in the Medrash Asar HaRugei Malchus and Eisenstein's Otzer Midrashim. So we know in the Kina, we say that they went up to Shemayim and they asked, is this the decree? The answer was yes, but we're not told why. In the Medrash, it says explicitly that the decree was you are condemned to death and by heaven because of the sin of the brothers of Yosef and selling Yosef. Midas Hadin, Mekatreges B'chal Yom, the Midah of Din is complaining that there was no justice for the sale. So the Medrash explicitly says that it was indeed a grievous sin for which they were being punished many centuries later. There's also a famous, much discussed comment of Rabbeinu Bachya. He says that even though we find later when the brothers went down to Egypt, they had a sort of reconciliation with Yosef. It says they, after Yaakov died, they fell at his feet. They begged him, please forgive us, have mercy on us. And he said, Ta'inachem, he comforted them. He said, it wasn't me, it was God. It was all part of God's master plan. Reina Bachya points out, if you read the Pesukim very closely, he never says the word forgiveness. He never said, I forgive you. He said, don't worry, it was all the divine decree. He never actually says, it's okay, I'm mochel, I forgive you. And because of that, Reina Bachya says, the Jews had to go down to Egypt, and we suffered for it because there never actually was forgiveness on the part of Yosef. So again, he also understands that it was indeed a sin, and a sin for which there was serious punishment. So Rabbi Yaakov here is arguing that the brothers weren't coarse and vulgar kidnappers. They had some kind of cheshbon. On the other hand, they were wrong. They're clearly, it's pretty clear in the mainstream Jewish tradition, not as explicit as I would like, but that the brothers did indeed commit a sin by selling Yosef. It may not have been as bad a sin as the Pesukim indicate at first blush, but it was clearly a sin. It was maybe not 100% clearly, but it does seem to have been a sin. So the question really remains, so why does the Torah tell it to us? So the first answer Rabbi Yaakov gives is very interesting, and it has important halachic ramifications. Rabbi Yaakov says the laws of Lashon Hara don't really apply to the dead. Once somebody dies, there is not really a problem anymore. And this is a debate in the post. Baruch HaShulchan, it brings the Gemara. He says that once somebody's dead, he's in the Olam HaEmes. He doesn't know what people say about him. If he doesn't know, he doesn't care. It doesn't matter anymore. He has other things to worry about, more important things than what people are gossiping about you. So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky takes this view. He says there is really the prohibitions against evil speech and slander, the various prohibitions do not apply vis-a-vis the dead. What there is, he says, is a cherem hakadmonim, an ancient ban, a medieval ban going back 1,000 years or so. There is an institution, a cherem, an anathema against speaking ill of the dead, but that's he says, that's limited to motzi shemra, to false libel. It does not apply to telling the truth. This is something which biographers would like to rely on. We discussed history, biography, the idea that as long as you're telling the truth, at least in the case where your subject is dead, then you aren't dealing with the laws of Lashon Hara. All you have is the cheirim, and the cheirim doesn't apply as long as you're telling the truth. This cheirim is brought lahalacha in Hilchos Erev Yom Kippur, where it talks about doing tshuva. It says anything between man and his fellow man, you have to ask forgiveness. And one sin that's singled out is this cheirim, the cheirim against being motzi shemra alameisim, against falsely libeling the dead. It says you can't ask them permission, they're not here anymore. What you have to do if you violated it is to go to the grave with 10 people and ask mechila. So as I mentioned earlier, there is a lot of debate in various authorities whether both points. Whether the cheirim is limited to false libel, motzi shemra, or applies even to true slander, to true libel. Rabbi Yaakov assumes only false, some say even true. And beyond that, there is a debate. Rabbi Yaakov assumes that the only thing is the cheirim, that the biblical prohibitions of Lashon Hara and Rechilas and Motzi Shemra don't apply to the dead. Others say, no, they do. Even though Rabbeinu Gershom made a cheirim, that was to strengthen it. Sometimes we find even things which are prohibited on a deraisa level, people get lax, so he made a cheirim to impress people. But it doesn't mean that the biblical prohibitions are not enforced. So both these points are debated by other authorities. Rabbi Yaakov takes the minimalist view that the biblical prohibitions do not apply and that the cheirim is all there is, and the cheirim is limited to hotzat shemra, which legitimizes what the Torah does in telling us about the failings of the great men of the Bible and women. Now, the truth is that there is, most of us, if we were asked this question, if someone asked us, why does the Torah tell us these stories, we would answer a different answer, which I think, I'm surprised Rabbi Yaakov doesn't say this, I think this is the most obvious and fundamental answer, which is, we all know the Torah does not tell us general history. There's a lot of interesting questions we could ask about life in the Bronze Ages or whenever it was. The Torah doesn't tell us. The Torah is not out to give us systematic, modern, neutral history. The Torah tells us what we need to know for our heritage, for theological lessons, for moral lessons, for halakhic lessons. Everything the Torah has is educational, is pedagogic in some way, and we're told what we need to know for the purposes of our religion. So the fundamental heter in general for Toelas, for Lashon Hara, is Toelas, that we're allowed to tell Lashon Hara when there is some constructive, beneficial purpose, when the goal is not to put people down and to insult people and to make them feel bad, when the goal is some positive, constructive good, then we do tell Lashon Hara. So almost by definition, everything in the Torah is, there's some reason the Torah tells us these things. We learn valuable lessons. So that lachara would have been one of the most basic reasons that would legitimize what the Torah does. And Rabbi Yaakov's reasons also are not general enough. The second reason is limited to the case of the brothers of Yosef, who they may have had a justification, but we know other cases where people did do sins. People, the Torah clearly identifies certain things as sins. And yet the Torah tells it to us. So you have to say something more basic. Either it's because they were dead, like he says, or because it's l'toeles, that it's important for us to know the lessons the Torah wants to teach us. These things are important for us to know. That would seem to be a major reason for the Torah being allowed to tell us these things. Now, there's an interesting argument about the heter of l'toeles. I came across this recently in a couple of different intersecting contexts. I was reading a blog post by Rabbi Natan Slifkin. He says that he was once criticizing a certain public figure, and someone asked him, isn't that Lashon Hara? So he said, it's l'toeles. People have to know that this person is a problematic figure. So the fellow asked him, well, that might be true, but you have an axe to grind. Your motives are not pure. He said, maybe so, but it doesn't matter. If objectively it's a toelis, if objectively there's some good, people need to know the truth about some public figure, then it's fine. So they asked him that. The Chafetz Chaim says, not like that. The Chafetz Chaim, in his laws, his classic work on the laws of Lashon Hara, explicitly says that you have to be mechavein l'toelis, that one of the conditions for saying Lashon Hara, rechilas, even when it's l'toelis, is that you have to actually have pure and altruistic motives without personal vendettas and access to grind. So he has a problem with that. He challenges the Chafetz Chaim. He's not sure if the Chafetz Chaim meant to la halacha, if it's strictly binding. He argues, why should that be? If objectively it's important for people to know that someone is a problematic figure, why does it matter what my intentions are? So the truth is, I recently encountered a direct machlokas about this from much earlier achronim, going back to the Sma and the Taz, two of the classic commentators on Choshen Mishpat, two of the early classic commentators on Shulchan Aruch Choshen Mishpat. The context is vigilantism. Touched on this last week with Gal Hadam and avenging murders, but the halacha is, in general, if I see Reuven beating up Shimon, Shimon is in trouble, he's getting the worst of an assault by Reuven, it's my right and my duty to step in and to save Shimon. Certainly, if I can extract Reuven without harming him, that's ideal. If I can't, I have the right and even the duty to hit back against Reuven to save his victim from his assault. You're commanded to do that. Lo samar al dam re'echa. There's a prohibition against allowing Jews to come to harm. If someone is harming him illegitimately without any just cause, I have the right to step in and take whatever action is necessary, including counter-assaulting the perpetrator to save his victim. Now, what if my motives are not so altruistic? I happen not to like Reuven. I'm angry at Reuven for something else. I say, here's my chance. I'll go in and I'll sock Reuven. You know, he deserves it now anyway, but I'll feel good about it because he crossed me the other day in some unrelated affair. Does that make a difference or not? So the Sma says, in such a case, you are not allowed to do it. You're only allowed to step in and act on behalf of Shimon and hit Reuven if your motives are pure, if you're consistent, if you do this every time you see someone like Moshe Rabbeinu. The commentators point out, Moshe Rabbeinu, he sees men fighting in Egypt. He interferes, he intervenes, he says, what are you doing? What are you doing? The next thing you know, he's fleeing Egypt because they informed on him to the palace. They told him about the murder he had done the day before or recently, where he had killed the Egyptian who was assaulting a Jew. The very first thing he does when he gets to Midian, he finds these defenseless girls, the outcasts of society, are being pushed around by the powerful shepherds. The very first thing he does is exactly the same thing. He jumps in, a stranger, he fights them off, he saves the girls. The commentators point out that was Moshe Rabbeinu. He couldn't tolerate injustice when he saw the weak being oppressed by the strong. He felt the need to step in and do what he could to right the injustice. So the Sma says, he doesn't mention Moshe, but he says, if you're such a person who consistently, altruistically, for pure motives, always steps in on behalf of the weak to save them from the strong, then fine. But if not, if you have personal motives, if you have vindictive motives against the person you're about to hit, then you should not be doing it. So the Taz says he doesn't understand. He thinks the Sma is wrong, and he doesn't understand what the logic is. He says, objectively, it's a good thing to knock people down to save their victims from being assaulted. So today you're doing the right thing. Yesterday you didn't do anything. Yesterday you did the wrong thing. Yesterday you were too lazy. You were too much of a coward. You didn't do anything. But today what you're doing is right. Who cares what your motive is? He says, motive is very nice, but it doesn't matter. He says, objectively, this is the right thing to do. Saving the victim from his oppressor is the correct course of action. It doesn't matter if you're consistent about it or not. In the justice system, we have the notion of selective enforcement. If you execute someone If you execute only black murderers and you let all the white ones go, that's not fair, even if the black ones are guilty. But if you're not enforcing the law across racial groups, that's not fair as a court. It's not fair as an act of government. But in general, the Taz says it doesn't matter. The fact that you're selectively saving victims, so what? Right now, the victim you're saving deserves to be saved. Right now, his perpetrator needs to be knocked down and chased off. It doesn't matter that yesterday you weren't interested and today you're doing it for personal motives. This machlokas ma'an taz actually is brought in indirectly to Hilchos Lashon Hara. There is a related discussion. In modern law, in American law at least, we have the notion of truth being an absolute defense against libel. Generally, unlike, let's say, England or other countries, which are much stricter about their libel laws, we have the notion that even in England, if you can prove it's true, it's okay, I think, but there the burden of proof maybe is more and more on you. But in general, certainly in the United States, we have the notion that truth is an absolute defense against libel. You can pretty much say whatever you want, and you're untouchable as long as it's true. The standards of proof might be different for public figures, for private figures, but that's all standard of proof. If the thing is undeniably true, then it's basically protected speech under our system of laws, and there is generally no consequence for true statements. What about in halacha? So Lashon Hara is certainly prohibited even on truthful statements. Certainly ab initio, you are not allowed to tell Lashon Hara. Rambam says that, the Chafetz Chaim says that, that's a pretty well accepted halacha. Lashon Hara is prohibited even when something is true. What about after the fact, in terms of a civil case for libel or for... So in halacha, we do have the notion of civil cases for libel. The halacha category is called boshes. We know that in the case of personal assault, personal injury, there are five causes of action: tsar, nezek, sheves, boshes, and ripui. Pain, loss of work, loss of long-term economic productivity, medical bills, and one of them is boshes, humiliation. Now the Gemara does say that baisho bedvarim is pater, that if you humiliate somebody merely verbally without physically assaulting them, that's not actionable. But there is an ancient takana going back to the time of the Gaonim. There is an ancient custom, an ancient institution that the Batei Din did find people liable and responsible for libel, for publicly humiliating someone, and they did find them accordingly. Now, the classic examples were when you called somebody an ugly name, you said an ugly statement about someone that was not true. You said he's a thief, you said he's an adulterer, you said he's a Mechalel Shabbos, and it wasn't true, that would be considered intolerable boshes dvarim, and the Batei Din did obligate you to pay for that. What if what you actually said was true? You called him a thief, and you can prove that it was true, he was a thief. Are you liable for any kind of penalty for insulting and humiliating and publicly defaming somebody else? So the Ramah rules, the Ramah says, that if you call somebody an Eved or a Mamzer, a slave or a Mamzer in the Jewish tradition doesn't mean a jerk, it means someone who has a technical problem with his ancestry, which makes him prohibited, has halachic ramifications, prohibited to marry an ordinary Jewish person. If you call him such a name, then you are held liable for publicly humiliating him and defaming him. However, if it's true, then you are off the hook. The Ramah seems to endorse the principle that truth is going to be a defense. Again, not l'chatchila necessarily, but at least b'di'eved, truth is going to be a defense against any liability for public slander. Now, there are achronim, the Chavos Yair and the Shvus Yaakov, who say that's only true in the specific case of Mamzer and Eved. These are matters of public interest because the Yichus question, who he's allowed to marry, is a major public concern. It's important that there be general knowledge of who's permitted and who's allowed to marry whom. And therefore, because of the public interest, we do not hold you liable for the slander. However, something which is of no or negligible public interest, for example, someone, when he was 13, he was caught shoplifting from the drugstore, or he did something, you know, with a girl a long time ago when he was a kid, and now he's a respectable householder who hasn't been on that same bad path, then these achronim say truth is no longer a defense against slander. The Europeans they talk about a right to be forgotten. That's pretty much what these achronim endorse. They say that a Jew has a right to be forgotten, the right of various shortcomings in his past. He has the right to say, it was a long time ago, I'm no longer continuing in those ways. The Gemara already tells us that you're not supposed to tell a Baal Tshuva, for example, you're not supposed to tell him, remember what you used to do before you did Tshuva. That's considered an Anas Dvarim, you're hurting his feelings. But here too, even if he hasn't done a full-blown tshuva, tshuva has certain rules. To be kosher l'edus, for example, you have to certify your tshuva, you have to demonstrate that you've reformed, even if you haven't done that. But if it's a long time ago in the past and we haven't had any ongoing problem with you, these achronim rule that this then falls into the category of actionable libel, and you actually have to pay for this, even though it's true. So that's absolutely true. Everything is relative. And since we're dealing, as we often do, with case law, so to speak, with tshuva svarim, the poskim aren't out to give us a formal and entirely useful definition. So you're right. To apply the standard to real-world cases, we would have to sit down and try to figure out the language I used was pretty much the language drawn from the achronim. It was a long time ago, when he was young, when he was hot-blooded, before he was settled down. He kind of sowed his wild oats when he was young. You're right. There are going to be a lot of intermediate cases, and I don't have a good workable definition for where to draw the line. That is something important, and as we'll discuss further in some of the other aspects of Lashon Hara, we'll see also that poskim sometimes discuss the easier cases, which are kind of more black and white. It's much harder to find definitive rules that govern the gray middle. So yeah, it's a good question. I don't have a completely good answer. But the Erech Shai disagrees. Shlomo Yehuda Tabak, a leading 19th century Choshen Mishpat expert, he disagrees. He says, no. He says, there's always some public good in knowing what somebody did, even if he's not an Eved, he's not a Mamzer, it's not an Ichus question. He said, if someone's a thief, if someone committed... Someone's a shoplifter, people have to know. First of all, he's possible for Eidus, for Shvua. The court has to know this. But beyond that, he says, people have to know to avoid such people. Now, again, if it was clearly something which is a complete youthful indiscretion, which has no bearing on his adult character, maybe even he would agree. I don't know. Again, it becomes somewhat a question of drawing lines. But in general, he disagrees. He says that even if someone has something in his past, it is a question of public interest. The public does have some interest in knowing. And therefore, he says that there is no cause for slander if the thing is true, even if it has no yichus consequence. And he adds, and it doesn't matter, he says, if your motivation was not the pious motivation of serving the public good, even if you were being a mean, vindictive person, you got into a fight with him, it doesn't matter. Just like the Taz says, we define something as either saving somebody, good Samaritan vigilantism, as opposed to unlawful assault is defined objectively by whether you are or are not saving an innocent victim, not by what your motivation was. Your motivation does not matter. In halacha, the action is characterized by its objective character, not by your personal subjective motivation. So to where he says, now he's not saying it's mutter l'chatchila to be vindictive about it. He does say l'chatchila, you shouldn't do it, which like the Chavetz Chaim says, but at the end of the day, he says, in terms of after the fact, is there a cause for action, for slander? The answer is no, since objectively this is something that serves the public interest. I think in general that's probably more the American view. Americans believe that the free speech is a fundamental right, certainly on questions that have any relevance to the public interest. If someone has a criminal record, the public has the right to know. It's more important than his right to privacy is the general right to be able to speak freely on questions that are relevant to the public. Now, you know, American law would give you the right to speak freely on something that's not relevant to the public too. Usually, halacha doesn't go that far, but certainly with something where there is at least some public interest, the Erech Shai is telling us that such an action is objectively not characterized as slander and is not actionable even if your motivations were petty and vindictive. Again, you shouldn't do it. L'chatchila, he says, that certainly l'chatchila, you should have good motives. You shouldn't act in a vindictive way. But fundamentally, your action is not characterized as slander, and your motive doesn't change that basic characterization. Now, we mentioned earlier, I think this is widely known, that the standard heter for Lashon Hara, the standard case which encompasses most of the dispensations we might have for evil speech, is the notion of toelos. That sometimes if there's something constructive, to be whether objectively constructive or even subjectively, that's your motivation too, whatever it is, the notion that if there's some objective need, some objective benefit from exposing certain facts, they have to be true, of course, but almost by definition, there can't be any objective good from falsely libeling somebody, but if the facts are true and there's some objective good, that's the heter of toelos, and that pretty much encompasses most of the cases in which Lashon Hara is permitted. Now, there's a very funny and kind of wickedly delicious passage in the Sefer Pesachei Tshuva. There are several svarim called Pesachei Tshuva. This is a somewhat lesser known one written in the late 19th century. Rabbi Isserlin, writing in Aruch Chaim, he says the Bali Musar, this is before the Chafetz Chaim still, he says the Bali Musar have made a great commotion about the evils of Lashon Hara, of slander, he says. I think, he says, the focus is a little bit wrong. I think the problem is not that there, the bigger problem, the greater problem, he says, is not that there is not is too much Lashon Hara. I think the problem is there's not enough Lashon Hara. I think there are many cases where Lashon Hara is called for, where people are too reluctant to mix in. That's, I think, an even more prevalent and more serious problem. As we mentioned earlier, there's an idea of Lo Samar al Dam Re'echa. A Jew has a moral halachic obligation to step in and save another Jew from harm. Under the law, as I understand it, being a good Samaritan is generally, maybe some exceptions, but in general, there is no good Samaritan obligation. If you drop your wallet, I have no responsibility. Once I pick it up, I can't keep it. I have to turn it into the police station. But I have no obligation to go pick up your wallet and run after you and give it to you. In the Torah, of course, you most certainly do. We call that Ashavas Aveda. And in general, Asamar al Dam Re'echa, do not stand by and watch the blood of your friend be spilled. In general, that is a major moral obligation. It's not usually actionable after the fact, b'di'evan. But certainly, l'chatchila, a Jew does have an obligation to take whatever action is necessary to save his fellow Jew from harm. And therefore, Rabbi Yisraelin says that many cases, if you see that someone is doing something else that's going to cause harm to his fellow Jew, you have an obligation to reveal the secrets, reveal this information to the victim, insofar as it will help him avoid being victimized by somebody else. And this, he feels, is a greater problem than the too much Lashon Hara. We can debate which problem is actually greater, but certainly this is a major problem too, and the Chafetz Chaim doesn't disagree with this. The Chafetz Chaim also repeatedly says that you do have a moral obligation to step in, a halachic obligation to step in and reveal information, even if you aren't asked. If you have information that you know is someone else is lacking and someone is going to come to harm because of it, you have an obligation to step in and reveal that information to the victim. Now, Rav Isserlin himself says, how do you decide when yes, when not, when is it going too far? So the litmus test he gives actually brings us back to that question about subjectivity. He says that there is a subjective dimension here, which is that examine your motives. If you are really doing it l'shem shemayim, then it's fine. If you're doing it for vindictive reasons, then maybe it's not so fine. You should think twice about what you are doing. Again, we said earlier we argued that the consensus seems to be that if objectively it's the right thing to do, you may have to do it even if your motives are not pure. Chafetz Chaim himself, in one of his discussions at this point, says that if there's an issue of Lo Samar al Dam Re'echa, don't just say, okay, because I have a grudge against this guy, I'm going to walk away. No, overcome your grudge. You do have to do it. You have to save the guy. So you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. You can't do it for vindictive reasons. You can't not do it at all either. So what you have to do is try to work on yourself, I guess. Try to overcome your pettiness and try to be a bigger person and do it just, not so easy, I guess, easier said than done, but just try to do it for the right reasons and not do it for the wrong reasons. There's a tshuva from, now this is what I mentioned earlier before to you also, that there's the poskim discuss and contemporary poskim discuss a number of practical applications of this, and they're kind of loaded toward the obvious. Most of these cases we would say, like, of course you have to tell, and that is the halach in these cases. That doesn't help so much for the gray areas in between, but just to quote a handful kind of representative contemporary responsa. So the Rabbi Yaakov Breisch of Switzerland, the Chalkas Yaakov, he was asked about a man and a woman were engaged to be married. Now, the person who asked the question knew, he was a doctor, or he somehow had information, that the man was afflicted with cancer, and the prognosis was not more than a year or two to live. He had not disclosed this to the woman. So should you mention this to the woman, that, by the way, the man you're about to marry doesn't have more than a year or two to live? And the answer is yes, absolutely you should. You should and you must. Because he says two arguments. First, he says, Lo Samar al Dam Re'echa. The woman would clearly would not want to do this if she knew the truth. It's clearly not in her best interest. It might be. Sometimes love conquers all. I guess you can have cases where she'd marry him anyway. But in many cases, he assumes the woman would not want to do this. It would not be in her best interest to do this. And therefore, he says, Lo Samar al Dam Re'echa obligates you to tell the information. Otherwise, that would be called Lashon Hara. Just to spread stories about a person's medical condition is obviously a terrible thing. But here, where someone's about to be victimized by a lack of information about this person, you absolutely have an obligation to tell.
The person who's telling is the doctor, is the physician of the man?
In his case, I don't remember if it was the physician or not. There are tshuvas about the physician specifically, and they discuss the confidentiality obligation. Yes, in the Chalkas Yaakov's case, he says it was a rofe charedi asked him the question. So it was a physician. I assume it was the physician of the man himself. He acknowledges the fact that there are confidentiality laws. Mechukos harofim shelo lomar. He claims that the law, he understood, I don't know if he was told accurately or not, he says they told him that the law was that he's not even supposed to tell the patient himself. I know that's a controversial issue. How much should doctors reveal to patients if it'll just destroy their peace of mind and make their diseases worse? He says he was told the law was they weren't even supposed to tell the patient himself. But should he tell the girl? I don't know if it's clear in this case if the man knew or not, whether he was deliberately entering into marriage with all the information, or just he may not have known himself. But nevertheless, he says the doctor should tell. There is a similar tshuva I don't have on the sheets. There's a similar tshuva of Rav Yehuda Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, who was an expert on medical halacha in general. He was also asked about a question of a doctor breaching his confidentiality requirements to reveal information the public needed to know. I think in his case, the case was there was a driver who had epilepsy, was prone to seizures, and he hadn't disclosed this to the licensing board. Now, obviously, it's a dangerous situation. If you're behind the wheel of a car and you're hit by a seizure, that's like a big problem. So the patient, you know, didn't want to give up his license. So the Sicily Ezra says the doctor, again, has a duty to the public to prevent fatal car accidents. He has a duty to the public to reveal this to the government, whoever would be interested. And he says that the rule always is you should first try to accomplish whatever you're trying to accomplish without resorting to Lashon Hara. But he says you should encourage a patient to reveal the truth himself, to give up his license. You should try other things, he says. But if you can't, if there's no other solution, then he says you have no choice. You have to reveal the information. You can't keep it a secret. You can't keep his privacy sacrosanct at the expense of grave danger to the public.
What's the source for confidentiality in Judaism? Is it Lashon Hara?
There are a number of overlapping issues. Lashon Hara is one in the case where the confidential information is objectively bad. In the case where the information is just private, that's probably a topic for a different conversation. There are a number of overlapping. There's not a thoroughly. There's not a thorough discussion of privacy it's kind of like the Supreme Court who invented privacy doctrine with penumbras. One of the things is the Chayim of Ben Gershom against intercepting mail. There is the notion of Hezek Ria we discussed a little while back, the notion of looking into people's windows, being able to see into their property. There is the idea of Lashon Hara and Rechilus. So the post can developed. There's a great classic modern Mishpat Ivri work by Professor Nachum Rockover called Hahaganah al Tzinat HaPrat, the protection for individual privacy. He did a masterful job of kind of assembling all the halachic sources and areas of halacha that have bearing on privacy, assembling them into some kind of framework, but there is no unified system of privacy in halacha. So the Tzitz Eliezer's case, they deal with Lashon Hara and Rechilus, but beyond that, they deal with the question of the oath. In the case of the doctors take an oath in some cases not to reveal confidential medical information, Tzitz Eliezer argues, as I recall, I don't have the quote in front of me, that the oath has an implicit condition. There is an implicit condition, I will not reveal information except insofar as it's necessary to save life, and that the oath is not assumed to be, like most things in Judaism, same thing in constitutional law or in any other discipline, nothing is really absolute. Everything is a question of your right goes this far until it intersects another right. Your free speech is almost absolute, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater and all that. So almost any right that we deal with is, even if the framers of the law didn't explicitly make exceptions, a reasonable system of law makes exceptions when balances different values. Halacha works the same way. Even when you're dealing with oaths and these various prohibitions against invasions of privacy and breaching confidentiality, but there are other values that trump. And in this case, an innocent person coming to harm because of his lack of knowledge of important information is considered a value by these poskim that overcomes the various prohibitions involved. The Rav Breish makes a second point that in addition to Los Amaral Damriecha, the duty that a Jew has to forestall harm befalling another Jew, he also says it's an issue of Lifnei Iver. Lifnei Iver, literally the Torah tells us, do not place a stumbling block before the blind. In the rabbinic tradition, it doesn't refer literally to a stumbling block, maybe that too, but it primarily refers to two other things. It refers to being an accomplice to someone committing a sin, providing someone with trey food or something that he needs to commit a sin, and also to the provision of bad advice, advice which is against the interest of the person receiving and acting on that advice. So the Reb Reish has a very interesting extension of that. Normally that applies to the active provision of bad advice. I tell you, you know what, go buy this house. It's a good deal and you know it's not a good deal. Or go sell your car for $5,000 and you know it's worth at least $12,000. So the active provision of bad advice is prohibited. It's allowed daraisa. But Reb Reish argues, at least according to some poskim, even passively allowing somebody to make a decision which you know is a bad decision and not stepping in and clarifying, explaining why it's a bad decision, that's passive lifneiver. You're allowing the blind to stumble without helping them see the way, see the right course of action. Even that's a problem, according to some poskim. So he argues, if you know information which would help somebody make a better decision than they're making, you have a moral duty to provide it to them, even if that information reflects badly on somebody else. So again, these are kind of easier cases where somebody's marrying someone who has a mortal illness, or where someone is driving and is in serious danger of a fatal car accident. Most cases that we're going to encounter on a daily basis are going to be much grayer and much less obvious. And again, the classic poskim don't give you, we mentioned earlier, Rav Isserlin has this guideline of consult your heart and see whether you're doing it for pure altruistic motives and not for vindictive motives. But again, that's only going to take you so far. There are a lot of cases where even if you are pure, even if your motives are good, it's still not going to be clear how important is this, how is it really essential. Most discussions you'll read of this topic will say something like, ask a rabbi. And the truth is, it is very difficult to give. It's kind of situational. It is very difficult to give clear and unambiguous guidelines about what's permitted and what's not permitted. Now,
I don't know, that doctor case is bothering me because it just seems like there's a relationship. I understand if you have epilepsy or you have a contagious disease and you're a threat to society or something like that. But here it's like, he has a relationship with the patient, almost like an agreed on, an assumed contractual agreement that, this is private information. And we're talking about an emotional and maybe monetary harm, so why should he, do I have to go and protect everybody who might get, don't lend him money because he might not, why is it his obligation? And who knows how long people are going to live? You can marry somebody and, they're not going to live that long either. And they think he only lives 2 years and live 100, whatever.
Right. So the Chafetz Chaim in general, his sefer, makes those kinds of points in general. For certain types of information, he says, why tell him? How do you know he's being straight with him either? There are two partners. Maybe both partners are crooked. Who knows what their arrangements are? And Shaduchim, who knows what the other side is not disclosing? You do reach a point sometimes where, both for practical reasons, it can't be your job to police the entire Klal Yisrael and to go being a clearinghouse for information and just going around knocking on people's doors and telling them secrets you found out about other people. I agree. At some point, it becomes just too much. In terms of your relationship with the patient, that's true. But I guess the idea is that the post can feel that relationship has a gvul, that it expires at that point where the patient is. My wife is a lawyer, so she tells me that. We all know about attorney-client privilege, that an attorney can't, the cardinal rule, can't reveal any information that was told to him under attorney-client privilege. However, my understanding is the one major exception to that is if your client is planning on committing a crime. If he tells you that tomorrow morning at 9:30 I'm going to knock off the First National Bank over there, you do tell the police, in spite of the fact that he told it to you under attorney-client privilege. Now that's kind of an easy case. It's an absolute crime. It's a concrete plan to commit a crime that you tell. So these poskim, I think, are looking at this kind of entering into a marriage on such a gross deception. I guess they're looking at, so the Debertiner, the Baron Moshe has a tshuva here. He talks about a case where he says he's often asked about a case where one party is concealing what we would call mental illness from the other party. He uses some somewhat quaint terms to describe it. He calls it chola tzavim, the sickness of the nerves, nervenkrankheit. He says, so he feels these are pretty serious things too. Even on, now again, mental illness, certainly by today's definition, it encompasses a huge variety of degrees. There's illness which is easily manageable by drugs, by therapy, which has, a person can live a perfectly normal life and keep it under control. Or if not, he'll have some minor outbreak, but he can live a normal life. There's disease, there are things we have to be committed to an institution that's not manageable. So and then there's everything in between, obviously. So again, it becomes very difficult for these tshuvas to know in the real world, in a concrete case, most cases you're dealing with are not going to be so extreme, so it becomes very difficult to know where to draw the line. Certainly in an extreme case, in Reb Reish's case, where the fellow only had a year or two to live, I think I understand his position, that's something which is such a great piece of information that the other spouse has the right to know. Or in the case where the driver, I don't know much about epilepsy and these types of neurological diseases, neurological disorders, but certainly if there is a significant risk for losing control of a vehicle, I can certainly see that the public health hazard if... I think that's probably fair.
The woman's decision in the example that you gave, we would say that's a sort of a sacrosanct decision
to reveal.
That the woman has to decide to marry this person, whether she knows the information or not, even if she does know the information.
Yeah, so I think that speaks also to what he was saying before, which is that halacha doesn't have as concrete and as fundamental a right to privacy as perhaps the law does. Halacha does have certain prohibitions, but they're not quite elevated to the same fundamental level that they are probably in modern American law. That's kind of to be expected. Almost any two legal systems are gonna weigh values differently. So this may very well be an example where even though halacha does have some privacy rights, they probably aren't. They may very well not be as a lot of that we said earlier, it goes both ways. In American law, we have First Amendment, which is a tremendous protection for people's right to reveal information and disclose and talk, and certainly in the United States, as opposed to Europe, but halacha has much less. Halacha has, certainly l'chatchila, has all kinds of very restrictive notions of slander, of defamation, of public humiliation. So yeah, the values are going to be different, and that's true, and we can debate, I guess, these are not gemaras. These are the assumptions of contemporary poskim. So there is probably some room for debate about where exactly to draw the line. And I hear the point. I don't have that much to say, but yeah.
Is there any consideration given to the chiyuv of the patient and his obligation to marry that revealing the information will prevent him from following through on his chiyuv of marriage and prior and revere before his untimely death?
So you're saying an argument against revealing the information would be that it would stop him from... So it's probably true, but I think the fundamental question, like he was saying, is the balance between the different values of protecting the woman, protecting the man. I think here, this would be a pretty safe bet to say that halacha would probably... You have a mitzvah, but you can't expect someone else, you can't force someone else to sacrifice his life to your mitzvah before your... So I think the value here would be... We understand that you have a need, but I think the fact that it's not fair to the woman would probably outweigh the fact that we want to give you the chance to do the mitzvah.